You're listening to the 10 Bagger Podcast, presented by The Daily Gold. Join us as we uncover tomorrow's 10 baggers today. And now here's your host, Jordan Royburn.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another edition of the 10 Bagger Podcast. With me today is a returning guest. He's Don Durrett, and Don is the founder of GoldStockData.com. He's also the author of many books, including How to Invest in Gold and Silver Stocks. You can get that on Amazon. Don will talk about that. But most importantly, I think of Don as he is the human encyclopedia when it comes to gold and silver stocks. You can ask him about any company, and he's going to know it. And that's why I'm having him back. First time in a while. Don, it's great to have you back. How are you doing today?
Hey, Jordan. Thanks for having me back.
So, Don, before we get into, you know, one question I have before we get into, you know, we're going to talk about macro stuff first, but I guess later to tease the audience. One question in my mind is, you know, given the correction that we've had in the sector, are there, you know, to you, what are the companies out there that weren't 10 bagger candidates before, but they are 10 bagger candidates now? So I'm just going to let that marinate for a while. But first, let's talk about the macro situation, because you think that the macro situation is going to, it's close to a point where it's going to turn very favorable for gold and silver, and then we'll see the end of this correction and the start of the next leg higher in the sector.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely want to start off with the macro picture, because that's really going to be determine if our thesis of investing in gold and silver and the miners makes any sense. So your first question, I actually have seven stocks that I'm going to list today for 10 baggers, so people stick around for that. So let's get into the macro picture. Let's look at, you know, gold's been in a 13-month correction. Why is it going to turn? So I actually thought that the turn, conceivably, when I say the turn, I mean basically we break out. You know, we go over 2850 in silver, we go over 1950 in gold. I thought that I was bearish starting in like late January, early February, for the breakout, because I thought in January gold and silver didn't do well, and I thought, uh-oh, we're in trouble. And I turned bearish that we're not going to break out until the market turns, and the market turns from risk on to risk off. And I basically came to the recognition, I basically stayed bearish all the way until September. And in September, we did get a 5% correction, but it got bought. And that was going to be the key. You know, does Wall Street continue this risk on buying stocks and basically ignoring gold and keep buying stocks? And they bought the dip, and that's where we're at. Today, we're at an all-time high in the S&P 500. But I think that was the first dip. I don't think it was the last one. I actually think that you know, I said I turned, you know, more bullish up towards gold in September. I'm still there. I'm still in the bullish camp because I think we're on the precipice. Now, I'm going to go down the list here, bullet points of why. I think it could happen. The next dip could happen in November. We're right there. We're a week away from November. November, December, January, I think we could see another dip. And the only thing we need for the risk on trade to flip is basically the dip doesn't get bought. And I think that's going to happen. So, you know, we were talking a little bit before we went on air, and I said that I think that the economy is weaker now than if you look in 2007 heading into 2008. I mean, much, much weaker. So, I mean, if we look at everything, if we look at inflation is the key, right? We had basically no inflation in 2007 heading into the 2008 recession year. Now inflation's raging. So if you look at, you know, it's at least at 5%, but if you look at the big items, if we look at rent, we look at food, we look at, you know, transportation, gasoline, the big three, you know, 5%, you're lucky. It's probably higher than that. So the money that people actually have to spend month to month is definitely biting, and it's going to continue to bite all through next year, which is going to hurt the economy. You know, COVID hasn't gone away. COVID has created a lot of economic damage. You know, going into the last recession, and I keep using 7-8, you know, we really didn't have any damage to the economy, right? Everything was basically going very strong. But now, you know, we have this serious damage where all these small businesses have been hurt. You know, we have these labor supply issues. Though I don't think those are going to really go away. And small business is going to get hurt. Discretionary spending is going to get, you know, sucked up because non-discretionary, which I just mentioned, those are going to take more of, you know, the family budget. You have interest rates. I don't think interest rates are going any lower than they are. You know, they're 1.6 for the 10%. Back, you know, 2007-08, you know, they basically could control interest rates. Now, I think the Fed is going to have, you know, they're going to have to basically copy Japan, use YCC, yield control curve, try to keep interest rates below 2.5%. I don't think they're going to be able to do it. I think you know, once we get above 2.5% on the 10-year, you're going to start having problems. The housing market is basically going to slam to a halt, I think. You know, you look at the high price, and we have a quasi-energy crisis going on right now. West Texas hit $84 today. People are paying $4, you know, $3.50 and above for gasoline. Most people are paying $4 and above in the country. I'm not sure. It depends. But we're getting to the point now where gasoline is getting really pricey. And then you got your utility bills. The natural gas is up to $6. It was at $2.50, 6 months ago. So our energy prices are going up. Utility bills are going up. You know, they're talking about coal shortages, you know, throughout the world. That's issues. Supply channels. Look at this. You know, people can't even get their car fixed because there's no parts. Port congestion. We've never seen anything like it. You know, it's like if you add up, you know, all those bullets, the economy is actually in a pretty precarious situation here. There's no reason for this risk on trade to keep going. The stock market is up 40% since January 2020. 40%. Is that really, do we really deserve those kind of returns? Is that going to keep going? I just don't see it. So I think the risk on trade is going to flip. Gold's going higher.
So let me play devil's advocate just for the sake of covering it from all angles. I mean, a skeptic to what you're saying, they could say, yeah, well, the economy, we have all these problems, but maybe some of those will get better and, you know, supply chain issues over time will improve. You know, COVID is going to wind down, you know, globally, there could be a recovery, a global recovery in these other areas. You know, they're going to pump money in. Does that at least, I mean, I'm to play devil's advocate, I'm not saying, I think what you're saying is perfectly valid, but it always comes down to an issue of timing. When do those things start to impact corporate profits? And when does inflation, when does the psychology of higher inflation set in? That's my question. The timing of all of that. I don't know if I asked a question there or gave a thought, but how would you respond to that?
No, you definitely asked the question, and it was a really good point you made. Your question is, are you sure you're right, Don? There's some other factors at play here. So the reason why I'm, you know, you never can be 100% sure that the economy is going to be weaker in 2022 and that gold is going to finally break out of this 13-month correction. But for me, the key to it all is two factors are kind of the key that kind of reinforce all these negative bullets that I mentioned. And that is, I don't see inflation going away. I see inflation basically staying with us next year, and inflation basically creating headaches in a lot of different areas. Also, the supply chains. I do not think the supply chain problem is going away anytime soon. And I think those supply chain issues are going to wreak havoc on the economy. Another point why my confidence level is high is stimulus, money printing. I don't think going into an election year, I do not think that Congress is going to be in a mood to basically do any stimulus, especially in the first half of next year. And then once you get to the second half of the year, you know, there's no way they're going to stimulate, right? They're going to basically fight. So I think a lot of these stimulus that we did for COVID, I think that's going to actually go down. And so, and I don't, and you know, the Fed wants to taper starting in December. I don't think they're going to be able to. But they're not going to be able to expand their balance sheet. You know, they're not going to be able to do any stimulus, if you will. So you're actually going into a year that I think is going to be weak, with the Congress and the Fed's hands somewhat tied, based on the last 2 years of stimulus, where they basically printed an unbelievable amount of money. Our money supply increased by 40%, you know, since COVID started. They can't keep doing that. They know they can't keep doing it. And so that in combination with everything else I said, everything seems to be pointing to a bad year economically for 2022. And for me, the key here is Wall Street. I mean, Wall Street is putting their money into stocks and a little bit into bonds. Well, a lot into bonds, actually. But if they take their money out of bonds because of inflation, so let's say that you have a 10-year bond that's paying 1.5%, but inflation's at 5%, you're losing 3.5% on your money. You basically say, okay, forget this, inflation's not going away, I'm selling my bonds, I'm tired of losing money. So where do they put their money? And if they sell stocks, where do they put their stocks? If they sell stocks, do they buy bonds and lose more money? So I see a selling in the stock market and in the bond market if the economy weakens. And that money, I see a chunk of that money trickling into gold and silver. And it won't take much. And once you get over $2,000 gold, then you create a trend, and then you create demand, and then basically more people enter the market. So everything, you know, I'm more bullish heading into this year than I was last year. I was bullish going into January because I thought that people would recognize that the Democratic administration of Biden coming into power would basically be anti-business, and they would basically, you know, buy gold, but it didn't happen. But now I think after a year, I think people are starting to recognize that the Biden administration is somewhat anti-business, and that we're heading into a recession year, and they're not going to be proactive on fixing the problem.
So regarding inflation, I think one caveat is, you know, the comparisons are year over year. And so how much probability is there that the price levels that we have now are going to be even higher next year? Because when I look at a lot of statistics and economic reports, I mean, they seem to factor in maybe 2 or 3% inflation next year. So I'm just, again, playing devil's advocate. Like, what's the probability that inflation is, I think that's the question, you know, is it going to come down from 5% to 3 or 4%, or is it going to come down to 2 or 3%?
I see it going higher because of two reasons. Energy prices. Now, if energy prices come down, you know, right now, like I said, West Texas today was $84. If it comes back down, say, to 70 or lower, then that's going to probably keep inflation under 5%, maybe even get it under 4. I really don't see us going under 4 first half of next year. So energy is going to be crucial, right? Natural gas is up to $6 for a million BTUs, I think it is. So in natural gas prices, if they come down as well, that's going to help. But I think inflation is going to stay high here the first half. It's not going to take a lot to basically get the economy in a tailspin, if you will. So the other thing is housing. I think rents are just going to go higher. I don't see rents really, you know, curtailing. I think that, you know, a lot of people are on leases. Those leases are low right now, and when those leases renew, I just don't see them getting a deal here. I see people getting really, you know, 5%, 10% increases on their rents. I think rent's going to be bad. I think food is going to be bad. Parts and all kinds of components that, you know, in the transportation industry. I could be wrong, but inflation is going to be one of those in very important numbers. But I don't see us going back down under 3% in the first half of next year. And like I said, once things turn negative, you tend to get this kind of this negative feedback loop where corporations, if their share prices go down, like if we do get a sell-off, you know, they tend to lay people off to maintain their free cash flow. So instead of hiring people, you start getting layoffs, and there's that negative feedback loop. The economy gets worse. So I'm very bearish the first half of next year, and I'm bullish gold. But yeah, being the devil's advocate, making me think, you know, you sure you're right, Don. You know, I can't be 100% right, but I am confident that, you know, Q1 and Q2 of next year are going to be supportive for gold and silver. We'll see. I could be.
So what's your view on the Fed hiking rates? Do you think they'll go ahead and do that? When might they do that? Or are they, I mean, is inflation's going to be bad enough so they just have to bite the bullet even if the economy's weak? What's your view on all that?
I see no way they raise rates in the first half of the year. But what they could do is they could do tapering. One thing about tapering is there's different ways that they spend money. So they could taper buying bonds and they could spend money in other places and their balance sheet could go up. So there's, you know, it's the net taper. It's the balance sheet that matters. Is the balance sheet getting bigger or smaller? The balance sheet is getting bigger, then they're printing money. If it's getting smaller, then they're shrinking the money supply. So I don't think they can shrink the money supply in the first half of next year, because if they shrink the money supply, that's going to hurt liquidity. It's going to hurt the economy. But maybe they will, and that fits into my thesis that the economy is going to get weaker in the first half. But, you know, lowering rates, I don't see that as a possibility in the first half of this year. Second half, we'll have to see where the economy is, you know, in the second quarter of next year. But no, I think rates are going to stay down. I think they're going to do they're going to have to do YCC, yield curve control, on the 10-year, because the 10-year is controlled by the market. It's not controlled by them. So I think that they're going to do what Japan did, and basically peg the 10-year at either 2%, 2.25, or 2.5. They're going to have to pick their poison and pick where they're going to peg it. They might not even say it publicly, but we'll figure it out pretty fast once it doesn't move. The Japanese, they peg theirs at zero. Their 10-year at zero, and so I think the U.S. is going to peg theirs at 2.5, 2.25. We'll see. I'm just guessing, but that's just my expectation. Because if the 10-year goes over 2.5, I think we have a big problem. That's my feeling. But I don't think they can allow it to go over 2.5. If it gets to 3.5, we're bankrupt as a country. We can't afford our interest payments.
Well, I don't think we'd be bankrupt, but I think we'd just have huge inflation from all the funny money that we'd be creating to.
Yeah, sorry, if I have to follow up on that, because people are going to go, what's he talking about, bankrupt? We have a printing machine. We can always print our interest payments. But I actually wrote a book called The Demise of America with a dollar bill on the front of it ripped in half. And that whole book is based on the theory that the U.S. cannot print their needs. In other words, if you don't get any foreign money, if no foreigners give you a one penny for these auctions, if we do these auctions every, you know, we're raising something like $100 billion a month. If we do $100 billion, if you do $2 trillion, it's almost $200 billion a month. If you do, let's say we do, right now it's about $150 billion, $2 trillion. So let's say we have to have an auction of $150 billion every single month. And no foreigners are buying bonds, that we have to print the money, and then U.S. investors as well. But then the U.S. investors don't want to buy it. So let's say the Fed has to basically print the entire thing. My book and what I'm saying right now is that's not feasible. The Fed cannot monetize. What I mean by monetize is they cannot print money for $150 billion of bonds month after month after month. That will not work. That's my point.
You mean it will not work without negative consequences?
That's right.
So just a side question, because you piqued my interest with the demise of America. I mean, haven't we already had a demise? It's like a slow motion collapse, basically, that has been happening for years and years. But, I mean, what are your thoughts on that? And after that, we'll get to the stuff that people really care about.
Right. Yeah, so that's the reason why I wrote the book. I think it's obvious that the American era is coming to an end. And the reason why is we haven't been generating enough wealth, for one, because since we haven't been generating enough wealth, this started in the 1980s, we generated enough wealth from 1945 to 1972, and then we stopped generating enough wealth. That's why we came off the gold standard. We stopped generating enough wealth, so we had to live off of debt, and we're living off of debt now. We're up to $28 trillion. And so that's not a really a good omen for the American empire, if you will. So we're steadily going broke. Number two is our political system. So our political system started fraying in the 1990s. So when you had Newt Gingrich with his I can't think of the name, what he called it. Newt Gingrich's
contract with America.
Contract with America, yeah. That was basically the beginning of the end of our political system, because basically what the Republicans did was say, we don't care about getting along with the Democrats. We're going our own way, the contract with America. So their contract was basically a contract of the Republican political way, right? And then the Democrats, they didn't know what to do. So they did nothing for about 10 years. But slowly during that period, from 2005 to 2015, they slowly, you know, you slowly saw this separation between the parties, where they slowly stopped talking to each other. Before the contract of America, the Democrats and Republicans basically used to talk to each other. They used to communicate. But that was the end. Instead of the contract of America, it was really the demise of America. That political. And then 2015, that's when Bernie Sanders basically announced his candidacy, and he created the Progressives. And the Progressives have done the exact same thing as Newt Gingrich. They created their own contract with America. The Green Deal was kind of somewhat of a contract with the Progressives. They call it the Green Deal, but it was very political if you read it. It's a long treatise as well. And their treatise is basically, we're going our own way as well. So our political system, the left and the right, is completely separated. And the American political system is completely separated. So we can no longer solve our problems. And so you have a political system that's broken, and you have an economic system that's broken. And so, yeah, it's over. It's over. America as we know it is not coming back. Now it's just a matter of what it turns into. And I think by the end of this decade, we will see a new America. I don't know what it's going to be. I'm optimistic, but it's going to be transformative. That's all I'll say. We're going to transition to something different. And technology and crypto and all that stuff all has to do with it.
Yeah, well, my buddy Dave Skirica, who's been in and out of the gold world, he always points out that a lot of great things came out of the UK and Britain, you know, when their empire ended after World War II. I mean, they went through some tough times, but like a lot of, you know, music and things like that, a lot of great things happened. So, I mean, it'll probably be rough along the transition to getting to that point, but you know what? Enough of that. Let's just worry about that later. Let's try and make some money in the meantime. Yeah. So we can escape whatever collapse is coming, you know, whatever collapse every gold bug has been predicting since the start of history. Right. Okay. So yeah, let's get to making money in stock picks, 'cause that's why people listen to things like this.
Right.
So that's something I'm curious about, Don, is we've had this big correction. And so, I mean, to you, what are the companies that, let's say maybe a year ago or 15 months ago, okay, well, this thing is a 3 or a 5 bagger, but now after this correction, you know, nothing has changed. The company's still in good shape, but because the prices are much, much lower, share prices, that is, this stock could now be a 7X or a 10X, like a 10-bagger. What are the new potential 10-baggers as a result of the market correction?
Right. Okay, so I have four producers and three developers. And the first two producers are new companies. And that's probably why they're cheap, because, you know, it takes a while for these companies to create a brand for people to find out about them. Most people don't even know who they are, even people in the business. So the first one I have is SilverX Mining, which is a small producer in Peru. And again, new company. I think they acquired a private mine. So they're a small producer. They have 70 million ounces of AGEQ, and they're producing 1.5 million ounces, and they're valued at $42 million. But they're going to grow. So I have them, you know, they have 70 million ounces. So if silver prices go up, I think they're going to make it to 3 million ounces. So if they're a 3 million ounce producer, they're currently valued at 42 million. So SilverX in Peru, I really like the management team. I've talked to the CEO. Both of these new silver companies, I really like the management teams and the CEOs of both of them. The second one is Guanajuato Silver. It's valued at 120 million, a little bit, you know, 3X of silver. And they actually have less silver, but it's higher grade. They have 25 million ounces, about 300 grams, and they're producing. They just started producing as well. They just, like last month. They're producing, I think they're going to try to ramp up to 2.5 million ounces. I don't know how long it's going to take them, but they actually have two. They actually bought a mine. So Guanajuato is a famous place, a famous mining district in Mexico. And they actually bought a mine in Guanajuato from Endeavor. So I think it's El Cubo. And then Pinawico is the one that they have. So they have two. And this Pinawico mine, I'm probably misspelling it and missaying it. It was mined very, very high grade back in the early 1900s. And it has, like, I think, eight levels. So they have lots of exploration coming in, exploration potential. And then El Cubo has exploration potential as well. So I'm valuing it at 40 million ounces as a 3 million ounce producer. So and like I said, I like both management teams. Those two are all four of these producers, I think, look like really good 10-baggers. The next one is Wiluna Mining. And Wiluna Mining, they basically have been a nightmare for investors. They've diluted investors into the ground. Their last management team basically made one mistake after another. But they have a new CEO, new management team, and they have 6 million ounces of gold in Western Australia, which is a great place to mine. They're mining 100,000 ounces today, and their valuation is only $123 million. Now, their costs are like $16.50. They're break-even. So between their high cost and their past performance, like, nobody wants to touch them with a 10-foot pole. Sometimes these companies, they get, you know, the retail crowd just leaves them, doesn't want to come back. And so Wiluna's basically been ignored. But here's the beauty about it is now they're making free cash flow. They have 6 million ounces. They have plans to increase production from 100,000 ounces to 250,000 ounces. And their plan is to reduce their all-in cost. Now, this is the break-even cost, from $16.50 to $13.50. So even if they go down to $1,400, if you're $1,400, so that's four. That's a nine. That's a good. If the gold goes to $2,500, their free cash flow is going to be $900 an ounce times 250,000. That's about $200 million in free cash flow, and their current market cap is 123. So Wiluna looks fabulous. The next producer is Great Panther. Great Panther is another one that's fallen on hard times, and a lot of people have sold it and said, I don't want to touch this thing, because their gold property in Brazil has had a couple problems with their pit, and they basically had this. They're currently, I think, they're not mining right now. And investors, you know, they don't have any patience. They don't look at the long term, but they can fix these issues. So if you look at it from a standpoint of opportunity, they're a 120,000 ounce producer in Brazil, and they're valued at $168 million. Well, that alone, that 120,000 ounce, that mine alone is worth a lot more than 168. Plus, you get their silver mines in Mexico, where they're mining 2.5 million ounces of silver. You know, they don't have low cost. I think their all in is about 1800, but they have free cash flow at both of these mines, and 168 million is just super cheap. So those are my four producers. You have any thoughts on those four producers before I talk about the developers?
Good question. Yeah, I'll share those with you off air.
Okay. You want me to keep going on the developers?
Yes, please.
Okay, you probably have some misgivings on some of these management teams. That's all right, I get that. The developer stories. So on developer stories, I'm really big on either one of two things. One, company has a path to production and it's cheap. And when I say path to production, I mean like within 3 years is my ideal path to production. And then the other one is an optionality play that's more like 4 to 5 years, but it's really cheap. So these first two are optionality plays. The first one is Discovery Metals, and they have a project in Mexico called Cordero. They have a market cap of $550 million, and you might think, whoa, Don, $550 million is a 10-bagger? Well, yeah, it is, because they have 1 billion ounces of silver equivalent, and they want to, their starting pit, their starting mine is 15,000 tons per day at 100 grams. So they're going to be producing 15 million, somewhere like 15 million ounces a year. So, and that's their starter, and they're probably going to increase them there. I have them as their mine is potentially 1.5 billion ounces of silver. And they're going to do a PEA, and everything looks, everything is really moving forward. I just hope that, and Eric Sprott has a big position in it, and I just hope they don't sell this project. I hope they make it to first pour. If they do, Discovery is just going to be worth a fortune at, you know, $7,500 silver. The next one is another really big mine. It's Chesapeake Gold, and they're only valued at $220 million, so they're cheap for what they have. Their project in Mexico is called Metates, and it has 18 million ounces of gold and 500 million ounces of silver. But the silver is a low grade, so they might not get, you know, high recovery rates. But they're testing something called the sulfide heap leach right now, and the early testing has been very positive. And I saw a presentation of theirs, and they're very confident that the sulfide heap leach is going to work. So they're looking at they have all their ducks in a row. I really like the CEO at Chesapeake. I also like CEO of Discovery, but the CEO of Chesapeake, he's got his ducks in a row for what he needs to do to get to construction in 2025. So if they get to construction in 2025, I think it jumps to $1 billion once they start construction. And it could even be higher than that, depending on the price of silver. And then it could run, you know, a lot higher than that. So both of these are long-term development optionality plays. But I really like them a lot. The last one, developer story, is more of a near-term, not near-term, but a path to production. It's construction ready. They just need to get the loan. It's Bear Creek Mining. They have 300 million ounces of silver, but it's low grade at 50 grams per ton. But they have a lot of zinc and lead for offsets. And they have like over 1 billion pounds of zinc. So it's basically a very economic silver mine with the offsets. But what makes the investment really attractive is they have more higher grade the first 3 years. So their silver production the first 3 years is 16 million ounces of silver. So those 3 years are basically going to pay off the mine and give them really high free cash flow, depending on what the price of silver is. But it's going to, they need to get the mine, the loan is $425 million. So it's a big loan. They think they can get it in the first quarter. Some people say, you know, the loan's too big. They're not going to be able to get it. So that's the risk. But if they do get the loan, this stock has 10-bagger potential, basically. So those are my three developers.
All right, so that's your list of seven?
Yep.
Excellent.
Seven 10-baggers for you guys. Now, okay, at what price? At what price are they 10-baggers? The gold companies, I have them at $2,500 gold. Now, some people think, what, $2,500 gold? Well, from my opinion, I don't invest for 1 to 2 years out. I invest for 3 to 5 years. 3 years from now, $2,500 gold, that's very feasible, very likely in my opinion. Silver, I use $100 silver. Now, the reason why I use $100 silver is because it's a round number. I probably should use $75 silver, but I started using $100 silver back in 2012, and I just stuck with it. So that's how I value them. My opinion is this on silver, is that I expect to have see shortages. Gold doesn't have this incredible upside potential, this leverage. And the reason why I say you're going to have shortages is that 80% of silver is used in fabrication. Only 20% is available for investors. And so if it goes over 20%, you have to basically use above ground inventory, and there's not a lot of it left. Last year, something like 50% of all the silver was for investors. Well, I'm saying investors, I'm also talking about ETFs. The ETFs soaking up like PSLV and SLV, and basically India. So these, if they soak up a lot of the annual supply, which is about 1 billion ounces, I think it's like 800 million mined and another 200 million recycle. But if the investors, if they want more than 20 or 25%, you got to get above ground. So my point is this, is that it's not going to take much for the above ground silver to run out for investors and for ETFs. And once we run out, once you have basically, once you can't find any silver, it's going to explode. That's my $100 silver thesis. And I think it'll go from, I don't think you're going to get shortages until you get to about $40 silver. 40, 50, 60 is where I expect to see shortages. Once you get shortages, I think we go to 75 fairly quickly. And then 75 to 100 is not much of a leap. So I don't think $100 silver is really crazy talk, if you will. If we do have shortages, you can do your own diligence about inventory supplies, about investors. You look at how much last year, how much investors bought. And I think it's like 400 million ounces or more.
Yeah, I mean, it's a question of timing. Just tell me, just generally speaking, tell me what year you think that's going to happen, because there's a lot of old timers who've been waiting for that for a while. And, you know, sad to say, but a lot of old timers have died off thinking they were going to see $100 silver.
Right.
And, you know, sad to say, but, some more might die off if it takes more than a couple of years.
Yeah, let me speak to that. So if you look at the silver chart, so $2,500 gold, I think, is nothing, right? That could happen, you know, in a year, no problem. So let's talk about $100 silver. So if you look at the silver chart from 1972, the monthly silver chart from 1972 until today, it's fairly amazing. It's like the biggest cup and handle you will ever see, ever. So there's that chart. Then if you look at the silver chart from 2011 till now, it's another cup and handle. So you have basically a cup and handle within a cup and handle. The reason why is because you have these huge cup and handles is because silver went to $50 very quickly in 1980. It basically just shot up, you know, from, you know, $200 to $800.
$2,
$2 to $50 in very short period of time. And so you have this spike all the way up. And so that basically creates this big cup, you know. And then the same thing happened in 2011. You had this big move in 6 months from $6 to $50 twice. So it happened twice. So that's what created it. But we have not spent very much time over $30 ever in silver's history. So even though the all-time high in silver is like almost 50, 49 something, 49.80, we've never been above 30 very long. So there's no resistance. There's no technical resistance once you get over 30. There's a little bit at 35, but not that much. So what's going to happen is this, is that once silver gets to 28.50, it's going to be a magnet to basically $30, because the last high was 2950. So you get to 2850, it basically, there's going to be a magnet to 2950. And then once you get to 2950, it's going to get to over 30. Then you got a magnet to 35. It's just going to zoop, go up to 35. It'll probably only spend one to three months at 35, and it probably won't even spend a month there. Once it gets over 35, I think it'll be less than 3 months before, to go from 35 to 50, because there's just no technical resistance. So the technical charts on silver are unbelievable. Once you get to 2850, you're probably going to $50 within 6 months. Last time it took 1 month for go to 1850 to 2950, 1 month. So that's the kind of explosiveness you have in silver. And that happened without shortages. And one final point I'll make on this is that the retail crowd, the Joe Sixpacks, they don't buy gold, they buy silver, but they only buy silver when it's trending. And so when silver gets to 30, 35, 40, the Joe Sixpacks, they all want to buy silver. They show up at the silver coin shops, or they go buy online and they want to buy silver. They buy silver at 35. They hate silver at 15. They hate silver at 25. They love it at 35. They love it at 40. They love it at 50. It's the strangest metal. Like I said, they don't like to buy gold, but they love to buy silver. So that's another thing. That's another factor, and that's what that's what's going to create your shortages of silver. The Joe Sixpacks are going to buy it all up. You won't be able to buy it online.
Yeah, just a couple of comments on what you're talking about. First, I'm happy to hear that you're talking about shortages in the context of a surging price, because there's a lot of people in the silver community. Every time silver drops quite a bit, they're whining about how there's shortages in silver. And I mean, look, the futures market really drives these markets, and you don't have shortages when the price is trading at a low or a multi-year low. I mean, it's the opposite, you know. Yeah, there's shortages, yeah, when the price goes up, like when it goes up big, right, time, like what you're talking about. The second, right, thing, I've always said this as a technical analyst by trade, 50 years from now or 30 years from now, you know, pick a long amount of time, technical analysis textbooks, the gold and silver cup and handle patterns, those are going to be like the godfather of that pattern, the cup and, right, handle patterns. Like people, practitioners of technical analysis, well into the future, will be talking about the cup and handles that are in the gold and silver charts right now. Like they're, right, we don't realize how significant those are. I mean, we will in the decades to follow. And right, so the technical analysis textbooks of the future, when they talk about cup and handle patterns, they're going to be talking about first and foremost the patterns in gold and silver right now. And also, I'd mentioned, you know, the quarter, if you look at the quarterly chart, I think there's quarterly resistance on silver. I want to say 35 or like 37, 38, something like that. So if we get a quarterly close at 38 or 39, I mean, that's a quarterly all-time high. So that, you know, it helps support the point that you're making. You know, if we can get a quarterly close in the high 30s, that could be a quarterly all-time high, and that implies that, you know, the market is probably going to continue to move easily to 50 and probably beyond that.
Absolutely. I love everything you just said. It's all spot on. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. One final point I wanted to make about this silver going to 100 is that silver in the ground, there's not a ton of it left. The grade keeps going down. There's not a lot of big silver mines found. There just isn't any. So once we get, it's going to be, you know, this is kind of the worst case scenario. If you're, you know, a silver bull and you're waiting this whole thing out, is that once we get to 2025, 2027 in that area, there's just not going to be enough silver. There's just not. And so it's not that far away. We're at 2021. Next year's 2022. I'm saying 2025, 2027, you're just, silver's going to be a problem. We're that close to the point where it doesn't even have to be any investors. The fabricators alone won't be able to find enough silver.
So lock up your silverware.
Oh, God.
At that point in time.
I mean, we're getting closer and closer to the point where these nutty numbers on silver, like I only go to 300. I'm a 100 to 300 guy on silver, 150 to 300 on silver. But some of these nutty silver calls are not going to be nutty when we get to 2027.
Well, sorry to interrupt. My call actually is I think we're going to see $1,000 silver.
All right.
It's going to be in the late 2030s, though. That's my.
There you go.
That's my call.
I think so. I really do. I think when we get to the 2030 area, I think we're going to see some nutty silver prices. Right now, we're at $24 silver. We're really looking at, you know, some unbelievable potential in silver. And people aren't buying it. It's like, gosh, I mean, they don't see this coming. And for me, it's very obvious. The only thing that's going to stop silver from going absolutely bonkers is the government basically saying this is a strategic metal.
Nationalizing all these mines. Yeah.
Well,
there's not. You're right. There's not even huge. I mean, because most silver's produced as a byproduct. So,
I think you won't be able to buy it. That's the buy it and sell it. That's the issue.
Yeah. No. Yeah. They won't. They'll outlaw investment of silver. But you know, that's going to be like a really long time into the future. People are worried about that stuff. Look, if that becomes a problem, that means you've made a shit ton of money on your silver investments. So.
Yeah. Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
That's not, I'm not worried about that right now.
It's not going to happen between now and, say, $60 silver. No way.
Well, on that note, Don, we got to wrap it up, but really enjoyed the conversation with you. Thanks so much for all your insights. Those seven future 10 baggers, a lot for our listeners to take in. And before I let you go one more time, please tell us about goldstockdata.com, how they can subscribe and how they can buy your latest book.
Right. Yeah. So goldstockdata.com. There's 900 gold and silver stocks in my database. It's very thorough. It's the other thing that's fantastic. If you do own any mining stocks, it's a great place to like track your portfolio. You know, any information. It's fabulous for that. And then if you don't own any stocks, then buy my book and basically see if you want to. So my book is basically a textbook, and it is on Amazon. Just go to Amazon and search for my name, Don Drette. You'll find the gold book. So, yeah, thanks for letting me plug that.
My pleasure, and thanks so much for coming on, Don. Really appreciate it. Look forward to talking to you again when we're talking when precious metals are in a confirmed new bull move.
Yeah, $32, $33 silver. I'll be back.
Thank you for listening to the 10 Bagger Podcast, presented by The Daily Gold. For premium coverage of precious metals and the best junior mining companies, visit thedailygold.com/premium.